can't decide and torn between a romantic, comedy, action, or an indie film to watch for the weekend? Well, well, well. Golden State Media Concepts Movie Podcast is your ultimate guide to the latest movies. Join us as we dissect the latest on the blockbusters. It's the Golden State Media Concepts Movie Podcast.
Welcome to the GSMC Movie Podcast, brought to you by GSMC Podcast Network. I'm your host, Stacey, and today we're talking about two movies based on real-life events, although taking those events in an interesting manner, and those two movies are American Animals and Mad to Be Normal. So the first movie, American Animals, is based off the real-life event in 2004, I believe, where four students, or at least previous students, came up with a plan to rob Transylvania University of some very rare books. A, yes, there is an actual Transylvania University, and B, it's not in Transylvania, it's actually in Kentucky, neither of which I knew. And the title comes from a quote by Charles Darwin. Sorry about the way I pronounced his name there. I don't know why I did that. Charles Darwin, about the American animals must have climbed out of the caves of Kentucky or something like that. They show it at the very beginning and it's just like, huh. But then you see that ties in later because one of the books these four men want to steal from the university is an original printing of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, where species is somehow actually misspelled. Which kind of, huh? How do you misspell like the title word in your book? But okay. So anyways, this events happened back in 2003, 2004, where a student at Transylvania University, Spencer, happened to see these books on like a class tour for some class he was doing or something. And he was really entranced somehow, for some reason, by this book by Audubon, which is where the Audubon Society comes from, who went around painting pretty much every bird in America. And so there's this picture of a flamingo, which for some odd reason really entrances Spencer, and he tells his friend Warren about it. And Warren is not the type of friend your parents want you to have. Like, we actually in this film have interviews with the real people, including the real Spencer and Warren and Chris and Chaz. I mean, Eric and Chaz, and their Spencer's parents and Warren's dad and a professor of something. It's not quite clear who the professor is, and the librarian who's involved in this incident as well. We get interviews with a lot of different real people while we're also seeing actors play these people. So there's an actor playing Spencer and there's the real Spencer, and there's actors playing Spencer's parents and then there's the real Spencer's parents, and the real Spencer's parents are like, yeah, we were not pleased with his friendship with Warren, but, you know, what do you do? So he happens to mention this to Warren for some reason, and it sort of comes into their heads. It's not quite clear whose idea it is, and because we have the interviews with the real people and this all happened like 15 years ago, going back and having the memory of it, you know, they disagree on even when this idea first got mentioned. Spencer thinks it was mentioned while they were in a car. Warren thinks it was mentioned while they were at a party. They can't even agree on where the setting was when they first started talking about it. So it's interesting to see them play it out where it's like, no, no, it was here. Okay, we show it there. And then, no, no, it was here. Okay, we show it there. And the actors sort of go along with how the real people are sort of describing it. And then if they're like, well, actually, that kind of changes. It's a very interesting way they're doing it. But anyways, they both kind of come to this idea of, hey, wouldn't it be great if we stole them? Because essentially they're just sort of unhappy with their lives. And this movie it really seems almost like a, not an after school movie per se, but just sort of a warning of, yeah, this is what can happen with bored youth. This is what can happen with youth who don't think their lives are doing anything. This is like the poster child for the problems of youth ennui. Like, Spencer wants something to happen. He's an art student and he kind of feels he needs to be one of those like starving artists or suffering artists for his art to really matter. He wants something to happen in his life, or otherwise, you know, there's no point to it. Even if that something is not necessarily a good thing, because, you know, the best people only came about to be best after sort of suffering or something. But anyways, they do eventually come up with this plan to steal these books. And it's quite interesting because, as Warren mentions, there aren't really books you can check out from the library on, you know, how to steal stuff. So they figure out sort of how to plan this by watching pretty much every heist film on DVD. And there's actually a point where they're imagining how this heist might go that's clearly, you know, sort of referencing Ocean's 11. It's got the Elvis song playing and they're in the suits and they move very swiftly and coolly, like, you know, there's no problem whatsoever. That's, of course, not how the real heist goes, or otherwise we wouldn't have this movie. But anyways, as they're going along planning, they determine, oh, we can't do it by ourselves. We need someone else. So they first bring in a friend of Warren's who seems to be really good with tactics and planning things out. But as they're talking about it with this friend, he's like, we can't do it with just three people because you'll need one getaway driver and two people in the library, but then you also need a lookout or something. We need at least one more. So they bring in Chaz. And it's interesting to see the way, you know, again, perceptions are different. Chaz thinks they wanted him because he's this great guy and very smart and intelligent and capable. And Warren's like, yeah, we really just wanted Chaz because he has money. So the way they, it's very interesting to see, you know, in the same way that witness testimony for crimes is always different and is very unreliable, the way they're all looking back at the same events is very unreliable. They can't agree on, you know, whose idea it was or who chose whatever or when things happened. They're all seeing it from their point of view. And since they all have different points of views, the story kind of changes with them. The actual heist, of course, doesn't go well. But it's quite amazing to see, A, it's quite amazing that they ever thought it would go well, because they're very clearly amateurs in a number of ways for this. But then B, the actual heist is, you're almost shocked that they didn't just chicken out because of the situation they get into with the first heist. They do start freaking out. There is a lot of cussing, a lot of using of the F word, as you would kind of imagine with, you know, 20-something guys in a stressful situation. That happens quite a bit. But beyond that, I don't know that it's too much of an R rating. It's mostly just the language. You do get the interviews feel very helpful in that it makes for an interesting setup, having the real people and then having the actors playing them. Some of them feel sort of on the side. You have Warren's dad, but I don't know that he actually says much. I think he just cries at one point, and then I'm not sure we actually get anything else with him. You get Spencer's parents for some things. You get, again, the professor who teaches engineering or something. There's drawings on the back blackboard behind him of, like, the mechanics of guns. I'm not sure why. And it's not clear if he's the professor we see in the film or a different professor. It's not clear who he is, and I'm not sure we ever get his name. But then you also, not till later, get the interview with the librarian and her take on it. And her take on it is very interesting because, you know, they're all sort of caught up in the greatness that will be this heist if they can pull it off, and how great they'll be and how much this will supposedly somehow mean for their lives. And of course, you know, they're thinking about it in terms of money. These are rare books, so they're worth, I think they come up with the number of 12 million somehow. But it's also, you can tell, really not as much about the money, particularly for Spencer and Warren. And maybe might be a bit more about the money for Chaz. But for Spencer and Warren, it's much more about just doing something with their lives and not just being mediocre, not just being, I guess, almost normal like anybody else, like everybody else, just being one in a crowd, but rather we're special, we're something else, we're not like all those little peons, you know. I think that's what a lot of people feel in their lives, particularly at that age. But it's interesting to see how caught up in, I need to do something, and I need to do something now while I'm still young enough to do it, that they get caught up in with for that, which is interesting considering that they first come up with the idea to disguise themselves as old men for the heist. So this playing of, oh, you know, we're going to pretend to be old men while we're really fretting about we have to do something with our youth, I think plays off pretty well. But yeah, beyond that, it's a little confusing. Actually, it doesn't start off too confusing, except you don't quite know who Spencer and Warren are at first. You do get a better introduction to the other two members of the team because they have to be brought on later. But since Spencer and Warren are the main guys and they already know each other, you start with Spencer and then he talks to Warren and he goes to Warren, and we don't get too much of an introduction into Warren. So there's a discussion where Spencer goes to Warren's house and his family's having some issues, and there's a conversation about him on a sports team and how he's at school on an athletic scholarship. And at the end of it, I'm still not sure what sport he actually plays. I want to say there's a picture at one point of what looks like a soccer team, but it's not clear if Warren's in that picture or if he's just looking at it because he's in the athletic director's office. He could be football. It's really not clear what sport Warren's supposed to be in at all, but you are supposed to get this idea of, okay, you're in Kentucky, you feel sort of trapped there, you feel sort of trapped by the setting of your life, and that you can't think of any other way out, so you come up with this really ridiculous and stupid and dangerous almost plan that of course is not going to work out, because that's why we have this movie. Having the interviews, I think, really helps. If you didn't have the interviews for this film, it would still be an interesting story, but I don't know that it would be, it would be telling its message in a different way, I guess. Because you have the interviews of the real people, and because they've now had, you know, roughly 15 years or so to look back on what they were doing and think about why they chose to do these things, even when they had opportunities at time to, you know, to back out of it and to refuse to do it, why they still chose to go along with what they knew was probably a bad idea. Sort of hindsight is 20/20 almost, except since we have the different viewpoints, hindsight's, actually I won't go into that because I don't know those numbers well enough for vision. I know my prescription, but I don't know it of the, you know, over 20 things. I know the actual like number for my contacts and glasses, so I'll stay away from that. But you do have this sort of idea that, okay, I've had this time to stop and think and reflect, and so this is a lesson, this is what I should have done, what have you. But then wait, that other guy who was also in the heist with me has had the same amount of time to stop and think and reflect, and yet somehow he's coming to a different conclusion, even though, you know, we both were in the same situation during and afterwards, and then we went our separate ways in life and somehow amazingly diverged on what this event means in our lives. And then at the end, you do get a sort of epilogue or afternote of the main characters involved with this story, what happened to them and where they are now. And without saying it directly, you do get that the filmmakers are making a statement a bit about the different characters. Not that they had favorites per se, or ones they liked more than others, but that they do seem to not even agree either with certain characters, but just that some people seem to have actually thought more about it than others, I guess, or just be more thinking in general or something. It was a very entertaining movie. I liked the way they did it back and forth with the actors and then the real people, the acted out scenes versus the interviews, because you don't actually have footage too much of the real life events, except at the very end you have one small clip of the real events and then that's it. So you only have these people talking about it and then this acted out version of it, of what it looked like kind of to them. But it's not confusing, I don't think, save for the, wait, I'm not sure who you are at the very beginning when the characters are introduced. But beyond that, once you get past that and you're like, okay, I know who you are and you are and you are and what your job is supposed to be in each of this, it flows pretty well. And it was very entertaining, except for, of course, the language at the heist, but that's to be expected. So we're going to take a short break. Stay tuned.
Watching TV has changed over time. Streaming has become the new norm. That's why Golden State Media Concepts television podcast dives headfirst to the world of cord cutting. Want to be on the loop of what's hot in Netflix? Or if it's not a preference, what about original shows in Hulu? We've got you covered. Join us as we fill in the blanks and talk about movies to stream and what show you should be binging. This is the Golden State Media Concepts television podcast.
Welcome back to the GSMC Movie Podcast. Our second film today is Mad to Be Normal, about the real-life Artie Lang and his house, I guess you would say, where people with mental health issues were allowed to go and just sort of be, I want to say free, but that's not quite it. So I had a hard time getting into this film, partly because of the era. It is the 60s, and there's a number of things where it seems like, ah, yes, this is the swinging 60s, and sort of anything goes, because when you start, there's just sort of free dancing, and then they're at a lecture, and you don't quite get who's who at first, but then you get Elizabeth Moss's character, who just jumps straight into a relationship with him in a very, you know, free way, even though she later finds out he's currently married but getting a divorce and has kids, but still decides to be in a relationship with him while living in the house with these people in a mental institution. There's one scene with everyone on LSD because it's, again, the 60s. We're just a little freer at times with our attitudes, and yet not free at times, because part of what made this house where this story takes place interesting is that Artie Lang was very much not for the sort of mental health treatments of the day. He didn't like the use of almost any drugs on mental health patients. He didn't like the use of electroshock therapy, which was very much in use at that time. You get one of the doctors who was sort of pro-electroshock therapy in this, says two or three times in the film, you know, we don't know why it works, we just know that it does work. And I'm just like, by what measure are you judging that it does work? Because the patients seem catatonic and or like they've just had a stroke or something. How is that, yes, it works to heal your mental health issues? Just and Artie Lang does bring that up at one point when a different doctor says, you know, we have to use the drugs on the patients because it's the only way some of them can get any peace. And he's like, well, is it their peace or your peace? Because it seems more that it's just for your benefit and not so much for the patients. So he's very much against the sort of standards of the time and is almost too far the other way, in that the house does have several people with definite mental health issues. I think there are a few of them are schizophrenic. One of them has postpartum depression. Several of them seem almost borderline suicidal. And yet they're just sort of allowed to do what they want in the house. They're not even required to talk to, there's Artie Lang and another doctor in the house. They're not even required to talk to them if they don't want to, but the doctors are there if they feel like it. But at one point, as you start meeting the characters in the house, you know, one of them has a knife and the doctor, one, the other doctor's trying to get that away from them. One of them takes a thorn from a rose and uses it to sort of slit her wrist. And I'm just like, I don't know that. On the one hand, I'm not for like, oh, let's tranquilize them till they can't do anything either. But on the other hand, I don't know that just letting them have free reign is exactly the right way to do it. But another reason I had trouble getting into this film is that Artie Lang is played by the Doctor from Doctor Who. And I was just like, oh, it's the Doctor. I didn't know that going in, but you have this interesting sort of flip going on with your hair at the back and a strong Scottish accent that I can't understand at times. And you're the Doctor, and they call you Doctor at times because you're an actual like mental health doctor. I almost feel like I'm watching an episode of Doctor Who for the first 20 or 30 minutes. I'm just like, this is strange enough that I've forgotten what it is I'm watching. Where are we? What's happening? Oh, this is based on a real life thing. That's right. I forgot. So there is a character in this called John who is brought from the doctor who's pro electroshock therapy. It's actually called ECT, but I cannot remember at the moment what that stands for. Is brought from him because his parents don't think that treatment is working. And while they're not too comfortable with Artie Lang's house either, they want their son to, you know, if not be healed, at least be healthy. And so they're like, okay, we're desperate. We're willing to try this. John is brought into the house, given his own room, and allowed to, it seems, be left alone for weeks and or months. Because he kind of disappears for most of the film, and then he shows up later, and there's a mention of, oh, you haven't eaten anything for weeks. And I'm like, you just let him not eat anything for weeks? Like, we do get a conversation later where they're clearly not for, like, force feeding with a tube patients who won't eat. But at the same time, I'm just like, what if these people died in this house? Do you have any sort of liability? Like, it's the 60s, so I'm not quite sure what the laws would have been at the time, but you're very relaxed about certain situations here. There's at one point a point where the woman with postpartum depression has taken a flame torch, I'm not even sure what to call it, to light candles and then started a fire, and they have to go get Artie Lang, who's at that moment actually attempting to have sex with Elizabeth Moss's character, Angie, to, you know, come deal with the patient. I'm just like, why do you have a flame, not a flamethrower, but why do you have a flame torch in this house with these people you know are not in the most stable of conditions? You didn't think anything might go wrong there? Just, what? And even Elizabeth Moss's character, who I won't say is the sanest, but is the closest in the house to the sort of outside perspective. When we start the film, she is a psychology PhD student. She mentions that she's studying Gestalt therapy, but that she's heard a lot about Artie Lang, and so she's very interested to meet him. And then she starts this relationship with him and lives with him in this house, and it seems stops going to school. But she at times is upset, not because they're in the house with these people who are potentially dangerous, not at first at least, but because he doesn't pay as much attention to her as she likes. He's very much more focused, according to her, on his patients, which is strange because in watching the film, it seems like he lets his patients have way more free reign than perhaps they should. So I'm not sure how focused he is on them at all. He's not ignoring them, but it's just like, fine, there's only two of you in the house, and there's, what, maybe half a dozen to a dozen patients in this house as well, so you can't be with all of them all the time. But they seem to be on their own quite a bit. I'm not quite sure why. Okay. But she decides, okay, the only thing he cares about more than his patients are his children, because he has five or six of them. So I'm going to have a baby, and then he'll pay attention to theoretically the baby, but also me. So she talks to him about it. And at first they have an argument, but then he's like, yeah, I'll do whatever. It's your body. So she gets pregnant, but then is upset when that doesn't seem to work. And I'm like, I don't know why you thought it would. And there's an interview with one of Artie Lang's sons talking about this film where he doesn't think it did a good representation of his father, and that it cut a lot of real people out and brought in a lot of fictional characters that didn't need to be there. And so it's not clear whether Elizabeth Moss's Angie is based off a real person or not. But it's just like, that just... Well, I really want to know what your thought process was of like, yeah, let me... This is somehow going to work in this house. And then when she has the baby, she's upset because there is a man in the house, and surprisingly only one man, who is potentially dangerous towards the baby, but she still stays there with Artie Lang, wanting him to get rid of this man, but not herself leaving the house. And it's just like, but why? You know, at one point, because he actually, you know, in front of everyone, verbally and somewhat physically threatens her and the baby, and yet she's still in the house later. And I'm just like, what are you doing? What is the possible thought process here that you're like, I will still stay? Because after that, there's a point where you, right before something bad happens, where she's in the room with the baby and Artie Lang, and they seem to be having this happy family moment, and then a different situation happens. But it's just like, why are you still there? If you're so upset about this dangerous man also still being in the house, why haven't you left? Like, it's not clear what your situation is, because it seems to be American, but in Scotland with this man, so it's not clear where you would go also in Scotland. But just, why are you there? I don't know. Elizabeth Moss actually does a really good job performance-wise, but her character is written in a way that you do kind of question what she's thinking at times to, A, get into this relationship in the first place, but then B, stay there. So there is possibly, I would say possibly the best scene and the only scene that actually makes it seem like Artie Lang actually might have had some good ideas regarding the treatment of mental health patients when, interestingly, not in the house, he actually goes to America to visit a different mental health facility and to like give a talk there, and there's a film crew following him for some reason. That scene involving a young girl in a padded room is really great, because you do see, oh, okay, his thought process is not to look at her like something's wrong, but to try and get to her level and connect with her in a way that she will understand, and to communicate not in, you know, sort of techno science professional babble, but in just real life, okay, you don't want to talk to me, well, we'll just sit here for a moment and we'll talk about something else that doesn't make you uncomfortable until you feel comfortable enough to talk to me, as opposed to, okay, let's go get some orderlies and tie her down and force feed her. He finds a whole different way to get her to eat. And it's a really nice scene to see how much he didn't care about just sort of the conventions at the time, but did care more about how can I have a positive impact on these people who are struggling with these issues. And then the rest of it is just sort of a crazy house in the 60s. Okay. There is this strange, it feels almost not real, cocktail party that comes up a couple of times, and it's not clear where that is. It doesn't seem to be in the house with the mental patients, but it does seem to be focused on Artie Lang, to the point where if he's not the one throwing it, he is the guest of honor. But this is more than one party, because they're in different clothes and it happens at different times and different events. So it's like this, a society thing that we get together every so often. It's not clear what that party is, but that party almost never ends well. And I get why it's there for the relationship between Elizabeth Moss's Angie and Artie Lang. You have two different things that happen at that party, those parties, if it's the same party or a not real party or whatever this party is, that clearly spell, you know, turning points in their relationship. And I get it for that, but it's a little strange, especially if that party's not real, why the filmmakers chose to do it in that manner without fully explaining, this is where we are at this party, this is how we got here, this is all these other people whose names we're not even going to show you, although they show up later. Like, it's like, okay, we are, but aren't, but are. So it was an interesting movie. The best thing about it is probably Elizabeth Moss's performance. But other than that, I was left more confused than anything else. And I was quite upset with the ending because it kind of just ends. And you get an afternote, but that afternote doesn't specifically explain what happens to the characters we were dealing with right before the end. So yeah, just a bit disappointing and strange. And I mean, if you're interested in A, mental health treatment at the time, or B, Artie Lang himself, it would be an interesting film to see. Although, again, his son did not feel it was a true representation of that sort of social experiment that the house was. But other than that, not sure it's really worth watching. So that's it for today. Thank you for listening to the GSMC Movie Podcast.
You've been listening to the Golden State Media Concepts Movie Podcast, part of the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. You can find this show and others like it at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Download our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Just type in GSMC to find all the shows from the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network, from movies to music, from sports to entertainment, and even weird news. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. Thank you, and we hope you have enjoyed today's program.